Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're done with your Oreo?
Yeah, done with my Oreo.
Okay, good. Do you really know what happened?
The brother did.
The brother, that's what I thought too!
I mean, that seems like kind of obvious.
Hey, do you want to talk about death?
Yeah. I mean, I...
Hey,
guys.
Hey.
Welcome to
Mystery Murdery Thingy.
Yeah. Oh my god, we said it at the same time.
Oh my god, wow. It's almost like we've done this before.
Oh my god, what episode is
just
this?
Just now. Episode 8080.
Wow, that's super exciting. Oh
right?
My god.
But it's been more weeks because we've like sort of skipped a couple of weeks. But anyway.
Anyway.
Impressive, right?
I'm impressed by us.
I did not honestly know if we were going to make it this far when we
started.
Well,
I remember
almost
the first
2 years
thing,
ago.
I remember like the first thing you like talked about was like, you were like, okay, well, we have to keep going, right?
Well, I feel like that's the charm of like podcasts that we like, you know, like My Favorite Murder or Last Podcast, like they've just been doing it for so long, you know. Or, like, Kind of Funny Games cast. They were talking about how they, like, used to do it in their, like, basement, like, years ago, you know? And it's like, yeah, that could be us. And then, like, people listen. When we were sitting in the fucking car talking. Like,
oh, my God.
Yeah.
Those
anyway,
were the days.
I'm Mario, by the way.
I'm Chloe.
I guess I'll go first.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because I always like to go first. Okay, so... I'm going to do another, like, kind of two-parter focusing on an area for, like, murder mysteries of this place. You know, we've done, like, murder in Great Britain. We've done the murdery Midwest. Now I'm doing murders in Africa. So just anywhere on the continent.
I'll do that and I'll join you next time.
Yeah.
Next week.
And, yeah, we'll both do it next week. Awesome. I mean, there's a lot, obviously. So this week I'm going to do a couple of unsolved single murders, and the next week I'm going to do at least one unsolved serial killer. So, okay, but...
There's murder everywhere.
It's true. It's a natural human phenomenon. It's unfortunate. It shouldn't happen, but unfortunately it's universal throughout all time and place and class and ethnicity and anything else. Like, people murder other people, and it's usually... It's usually the husband or the wife or a family member or someone you... That's what's so creepy about it. And definitely one of these is gonna involve that, but not the first one. So the first one I'm going to do starts out early in the morning on Saturday, July 9th of 2016.
Okay.
So not too long ago. So it's real early, and it's on a dirt road behind a mosque in the outskirts of the capital city of Nigeria, which is called Abuja. But this is, like, way out, you know.
Oh, I have Nigerian blood.
Oh, look at you. So, specifically, this was in the Gbazango extension area of Kubwa. So this Kubwa is, like, a little satellite city of Abuja, and this is, like, this little, like, kind of industrial area. And this is also where this woman named Eunice Olawale likes to go and do her morning preaching. Every morning, without fail, pretty much, she's there between 5 and 6 a.m. So she said, set herself up, right, replete with her Bible, her bullhorn, you know, her she was just there doing her street preacher thing, right? And we've covered some street preachers, you know, in the past. Henry Weston Smith, if you recall, from Deadwood. And Clarence 13X, you know, in Brooklyn in the 20th century. Again, this is one of these universal human phenomena of people doing street preaching, which I think is pretty cool. Even though I'm not a religious person myself. It's a cool idea. Someone go out there and just, like, feel compelled to just, like, say their piece, you know.
There's a couple street preachers on campus all the time.
Yes. And, you know, these obviously it varies, right? I'm not, like, endorsing everyone who's ever done street preaching at all. or any of them necessarily, but I'm saying. Okay. So anyway, Eunice was out there doing her thing. And according to sources, this kind of one particular witness, I guess, that as to kind of what happened next. So according to a witness named Emmanuel Assonwa, who told this magazine Pulse, quote, "I was exercising within my compound that early morning when I heard footsteps of people running. They pursued the woman from this way, pointing at an opposite direction, before they killed her near that transformer," he said. "When I heard her shouting in the footsteps, I just went inside my house. My neighbors and I were discussing the issue when a guy in my compound, who went clubbing the previous night, came back with news that a woman was killed behind the transformer. I had never seen her before until that day, but most people here said she is a very nice and peaceful woman." Close quote, which is what everyone also kind of says about Eunice Olawale, that she was very, like, devout and outspoken, but she was, like, very nice. She didn't, and her husband said this too and everything, like, she didn't necessarily have any, you know, known enemies per se. But there is this kind of, you know, in Nigeria, as with a lot of other countries, a lot of tensions between different religious groups, right? Specifically between Christians and Muslims. Not only between those two groups, but in this specific area between those two groups. For example, Eunice Olawale and her family lived right next to a mosque, and the place where she liked to preach was next to a different mosque. It was they were, you know, in sort of eye-to-eye conflict with one another. And Eunice actually had recently suspended her preaching because of threats that she had been kind of, like, hearing about. So, you know, when she left that, her husband, Elisha, that morning, they both kind of were aware, you know, that it was kind of dangerous what she was doing. I think it's kind of necessary for that kind of context. So again, it's like this recurrent thing where people, they know they're in danger, but they know that this is, like, what they have to do, right? Which is interesting.
Yeah, we've had a couple people, we've talked about that before.
Again, but, and sometimes, unfortunately, it leads people to their death, you know? And it's, I'm not blaming her, like, or anyone else who does that, right? I want to make that clear. But it's a tragic circumstance, right? I think is maybe the best way of saying it. So she'd recently suspended for about a week, but on this morning, you know, she felt like the pull was too great, and she had to go out there and do her thing. So specifically, they had, okay, it was like a few things. So there was like this guy from the mosque that they lived right next to who had come by asking for food for, like, the Islamic school. And Eunice was like, "We don't have any food. I'm sorry. Like, we can't give you any food." And he went away. So that was, like, one kind of maybe negative interaction. Like, this was right before her death. Just trying to, like, establish, like, the circumstance, right? Mm-hmm. And then Eunice had also overheard some Muslims on the street saying that they were going to chase, like, her specifically, like, making this plan, basically, to chase her away from her spot. And that was when she kind of decided to take the break, right? But then a week later, again, she decided to go back. So the news of this preacher woman being killed kind of spread quickly around the neighborhood, right? So it was between, like, 5:30 and 6 a.m. or so. I kind of read conflicting things about the time exactly, but it was sometime before 6:30 a.m. And the first reports that came out, as sometimes happens, were, like, one, incorrect, and two, like, more sensational than reality. What was first being kind of spread around was that she had been stabbed and also decapitated. And that her head had been placed, like, on the Bible there at the spot.
God.
With the megaphone next to her. That was not the case. That's more, you know, and I don't, you know, again, we're not, like, here to, like, revel in gruesome details. It's about, like, this person, you know, and Eunice Olawale was, like, a person who was murdered, but it's, like, something that tends to happen, right? And I only say that to demonstrate that, like, But that's not what actually happened. She was stabbed in the stomach. Her throat was slit. And she was murdered, right? But it wasn't that, like, I don't know, movie dramatic or something. Yeah. It was like a real thing. And blood was just pooled there. Oh. Yeah, just like on this kind of essentially the side of this kind of like dirt street, you know. So reportedly there had been nothing stolen from her, including the Bible and the megaphone. There wasn't much that could have necessarily, but again, if we're talking about intent or motive, you know. So yeah, the first that Eunice's husband, Elijah, heard about it was from his two sons. Now at this point they don't know that it's her necessarily, but the two sons who were out playing soccer have heard from some other, like, boys who were playing with them that this preacher had been killed, this female preacher had been killed. And here's kind of how a neighbor, a woman who goes by the mononym, she only goes by one name, Asabe, described what happened. She said, quote, "Mrs. Olawale normally go out for evangelism every day, and she was well known in this area. We heard that a woman was killed around Pipeline Junction, some meters from the house. In fact, it was one of her sons who came back to tell his father that he learned a preacher was killed at the Pipeline Junction. We all went there and saw a lot of blood on the ground, but the police had evacuated her corpse to their station. When Mr. Elisha got to the station and saw his wife's corpse, he fainted and had to be revived."
Oh my God.
Close quote. So, yeah, it's just devastating. And she had 7 children. I didn't mention that. 7 children.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, oldest was 15 at the time that she was killed. So, yeah, they, you know, didn't know, but then they found out when they actually saw her body. I think what they said is that her body had just arrived, and it was still in kind of the van in which they were, you know, taking it to the station when the family got there. And the police, you know, say, yeah, we're going to do, you know, this was a pretty high profile crime in this, like, you know, part of, you know, in Cuba.
She was pretty well known, right?
She was well known in the neighborhood for sure. And it was seen as a symbol kind of even nationally. And this is, like I said, right. You know, this is like something happens in a, you know, Fairfax, Virginia or something, you know, it's like near Washington, D.C.
Okay, I was, you know, like, why was that so specific?
Oh, I don't know. You know, somewhere right outside of our capital, I guess I'm saying. But anyway, what was I going to say? The wife of the president actually came. I think it was the president or the governor, I can't remember, came to, like, console and like, pay her kind of respects after it happened as well. So it was like, a pretty high-profile crime. And like I said, the police said, you know, we're going to thoroughly investigate this. We're going to get to the bottom of this. They even kind of got consultation with a higher kind of regional level of police. There were some early reports. There were these 6 guys who got arrested. And that's really all that I ever heard about it and any investigation. It seems to have not really happened, certainly not in the thorough manner that they told us that they were going to do, the Cuba police and this regional police force. But yeah, it's unfortunate. And this, again, why these mysteries happen a lot of the times, and not just because in Abuja, you know,
everywhere.
Nairobi,
really
everywhere. Here, Bloomington, Illinois included, like literally every place on the earth where there are police, they don't do a good enough job of finding out who murdered other people to very varying extents. Look at different states even. Have and different municipalities. Baltimore, it's like 30% murder clearance rate.
What?
There are parts of Chicago where it's less than that.
That's fucked up.
There are 5 neighborhoods in Chicago, 4 or 5 blocks in Chicago where like 30% of the murders happen. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, we've talked about that before.
It's crazy stuff like that. But anyway, I kind of got off the rails there a little bit. But a lot of the neighbors, you know, who gave quotes to the sources, right, that I read, seemed to basically assume or kind of intimate that Eunice's killers were kind of these young men, right, who were attendants of the mosque or mosques in that area. I'd never heard about any evidence to that effect necessarily. Who's to say? But that's what everyone seemed to kind of think that it was. And again, that was kind of the wider view of it in the nation and the press, right? It was seen as this kind of like flashpoint of the conflict between the Christians and the Muslims, okay. You know, in, you know, not only, you know, Abuja, Nairobi, Nigeria, but like, you know, like the wider African continent as well. So yeah, a lot was made of it, but not a lot was done necessarily to like investigate, which is unfortunate. So I'll kind of give the last words on this one to Eunice's husband, Elijah.
Okay. Yeah,
quote, "I see her as a martyr, and she died for Christ. And whether the people are caught or not, they should forgive them. My prayer is that if they can accept Christ, that will be a gain to Christ," the bereaved husband said. So, and like I said, you know, she and her I mean, this was their whole thing. You know, she was out there, you know, on her mission, you know, fulfilling her duty as she saw it when she was, and I think that's an important part of this case, right? That it, and whether it was, you know, these Muslim, you know, young men who killed her or not, right? Clearly that's the cast in which this story has been told. And it's hard not to see it that way just from looking at her, just from the victim's perspective, right? Certainly that's how the family and her friends saw it. But like I said, who's to know? It's completely mysterious because no proper investigation at all seems to have been done. So I just want to be super clear that like we cannot say anything about who did this, even though it was done on a fairly busy street on, you know, on a, well, it was a Saturday morning, but still, I don't know. It's crazy. Like, again, fuck people who don't properly investigate. Okay, so my second and final story for this week is pretty different. But it's still the unsolved killing of a single woman. It's the unsolved killing of this woman, Karine Chepchumba. So at the time of her death, Karine was, and this was February 12th of 2012 was the date that she died.
Okay, so a little bit earlier than...
A little bit earlier, yeah. Karine was a successful, upwardly mobile young woman working for Kenya Power, which is the main electrical supplier for Kenya. But she was also living kind of a double life. So she had become friends, or possibly more than friends, with this older, famous man, whose name is Louis Otieno, who is apparently very famous in Kenya as a TV host, a TV anchor, like a news anchor, like a hard-hitting, like Chris Matthews, hardball kind of, you know, type anchor. And Louis Otieno was famous for being on TV, but he was also famous for living a very lavish lifestyle, as if he were rich. He bought expensive tailored suits, he ate at expensive restaurants, he drove fancy cars, drank fancy wine, he loved real expensive cigars. But only problem is, Louis wasn't really making this money, right? He wasn't making enough money to fund this lifestyle, so he had to look for other ways. And Karine's father claimed that one of the ways that he funded this lavish lifestyle was extorting money from Karine Chepchumba, from the victim. And so this is Karine's father speaking, or you know, attesting to this, and apparently other people did too at the inquest. And what they attested to, what Karine's father attested to, was that essentially Karine was borrowing large sums of money from him, from, you know, family, for some reason, right? He didn't know, but he found this out. And on one occasion, Karine had even stolen a fairly large amount of money from him, from her father. So clearly something crazy was going on, right? And it's not like she does this on a normal basis. It was very out of character. She was, you know, good student. You know, like I said, she had a good job. She was living on her own, had an apartment. But it all kind of started going south, right?
Everything goes to shit when money's involved.
Money, what do they say? The lust for money is the root of all evil or something. Karine was kind of pushed, you know, to extremis by this, you know, extortion, essentially, if that's what was happening, where Otieno was you know, needing this money, right, to fund his not only lavish lifestyle, but also apparently his children's school fees, his rent, his health care. So, yeah, very strange circumstance, I think. So anyway, as a consequence of this, it was just kind of unsustainable. And according to Corrine's uncle, Edward Bittock, Corrine was planning on filing charges against Louis Otieno soon for extortion and getting a restraining order against him to not come by her apartment anymore, because apparently he would come by there and, yeah.
Be creepy.
Well, we don't know. That's a part of it that's pretty mysterious. Whether was he being creepy? Were they actually together secretly?
Oh, okay. So,
or were they not at all? He says they weren't.
Oh, we don't know for sure.
We don't really know for sure.
Okay, I thought.
But it seems like they were. Okay. And in some of the press reports, it's like kind of assumed, but it was not entirely clear. And some of the reporting on this is from it's a little more of the. It seems like a little more of like the People magazine kind of thing from. You know, from Kenya. So it's not as hard. Well, I say that People magazine has hard reporting too. But anyway, so everything was coming to a head, though. That's my point. And shortly thereafter, Corrine Chepchumba was found strangled to death in her apartment. Seems like there's probably some connection here, right? Like, if she was in fact getting extorted, like, how could this not? Right. Anyway, everything seems to be pointing in the direction of this guy, Louis Otieno, right? So that's kind of how I'm setting up that, of course, Louis Otieno vehemently denied this and was quickly cleared completely by the police shortly after the crime happened at his specific request.
Is it because he's... It seems like he bought somebody out.
I mean, again, who knows? But a little strange. Okay. Also, they didn't really do any forensics on him at all. They didn't get nail clippings to see if there were, you know, signs of defensive wounds. This is in 2012. It's pretty bad. And they didn't do any DNA analysis on him. They didn't get his DNA profile. They just didn't. They just never got it, and they still have. Or as far as the last thing that I read, hadn't gotten it, and they also didn't actually look at the GPS tracker on his phone to substantiate what he said his alibi was, that he was in a different city that day. But they didn't actually look at his GPS tracker.
He did it.
So anyway, we don't know. It's a mystery. They're always a mystery. That's why we never will be sued for libel, because we can always just say. Yeah, but our whole point is we don't accuse anyone of anything.
That's
it's all
a mystery.
It's a mystery.
He did it.
Sometimes more or less of a mystery. So, when the inquest... Oh, and by the way, the inquest, right, it wasn't convened for 4 years for some reason.
Wait, what does that mean?
It means that the police were just like, well, we'll look into it, and then 4 years later, we'll have an inquest where the coroner will decide the... You know, manner of death and
why?
Who might have done it.
Oh, and that's the question, I guess, right? Yeah. Oh,
doesn't Jesus. Seem above board. Doesn't seem entirely above board to me. But again, I'm not making any specific accusations. I'm just throwing a lot of shade.
throwing a lot of shade there, aren't you? It's dark in here.
You know who else was throwing a lot of shade? The coroner at that inquest was throwing a shit ton of shade at the police.
Well,
like calling them out and specifically saying that they bungled the investigation. Like, literally with that word. Massively bungled the investigation.
It's a good word.
And apparently that's what happened here. Because, again, it happens all the fucking time. way too often. What the coroner did say, though, was that, quote, the cause of Corrine's death was not suicide. It was not accidental. The cause of death of Corrine Chepchumba Keeley cannot be said to be undetermined. The cause was strangulation. These are inevitable findings. But that's all he could say. Because as to who did it, again... Police didn't really seem to be doing their job in terms of finding that out. So
that's
it's
so
impossible
frustrating.
To say.
I feel like those are the most frustrating cases. The one where like It should have been something that had a high possibility of being solved with proper investigation, but it's not there. And the number one case that fucks me up with is, of course, the JonBenet Ramsey case. Sure. That shit pisses me off.
Sure, but it's, you know, it's a lot of cases. So the last report I read was from June 2018, so about a year ago. But it was just kind of updating that there's not really anything, you know, and it was kind of telling the story. So while a pall of suspicion continues to hang over Luis Otieno.
A what of suspicion?
A pall. A penumbra. A cloud.
How do you spell that?
P-A-L-L.
P-A-L-L.
I had to look it up to make sure I was using it correctly, and I was, and I was. Humble brag. So while a pall of suspicion continued to hang over Luis Otieno, as his health deteriorated, as he faded from the public eye over the next few years, and apparently the piece of shit he apparently was, Corrine's murder remains very much mysterious. And apparently will continue to be, unless people do their fucking job. So anyway, like I said, next week, more African murder mysteries. I guess Chloe's going to get in on the game, so that's cool. And
for sure.
We'll talk about it. So let me do my sources. The Kwai Kwarty's website, kwaikwarty.com. Wikipedia, The Murder of Eunice Olawale.
Wikipedia!
Right. Adelane Adepegba at Punch. Kingsley Omonobi, John Bosco Akba Kwuru, Emmanuel Jana at Vanguard Sahara Reporters, Goodness Adeyochie at Pulse, George Thomas at CBN News, Benson Matheka writing for Nairobi News and Daily Nation, Martin Seeley at Kenyans.co.ke, Pakemoy Ngano at SDE, and Annette Wambulwa at The Star.
That's a lot of sources.
Yes.
Okay. That was good. That was good. That was very tragic.
It was interesting that they were like kind of the same, but kind of a lot different too. Anyway. Yeah.
So we didn't discuss, we didn't like get together and discuss, hey, what are you doing this week? What are you doing this week? And I think it's interesting that you chose a murder from Africa because I am doing, it's not a murder from Africa, but it is a mystery about an African-American cemetery.
Oh, okay.
So this is the story of Zion Cemetery. So I'm going to start off by saying that I got this idea from Reddit, and the reporters themselves did an AMA and Ask Me Anything on Reddit, and they presented their story and their findings, and there's a series of articles with the facts and all types of things, and there's one main long-form article with the story, and so that's where I got my source from. The reporter's name is in here.
Somewhere. And that reporter's name is
I think his name is like Paul Guzzo. Yes.
Okay,
yes. All right. So this is and just like yours is it's tragic and it's sad and this is what happens in American history and our terrible, terrible history of racism, especially against those in the African-American community. So this is in Tampa Bay, Florida. Zion Cemetery was the first African-American cemetery recognized by the city. It once occupied 2.5 acres of land, about 800 or so graves. And there is no sign of it anymore. It was on a North Florida Avenue stretch, and it's now a couple of Columbia restaurant warehouses, and it's also the back of a housing complex. So that's what's left of it. Fucking sad. It was established in 1901, and There's a lot of issues here and why it's a mystery. And one of them is because, the main reason is because African Americans in this time and still today were treated as second class citizens. So not a lot of deaths were recorded. Graves went unmarked. Documents and burials and maybe even relocations that should have been documented and reported on were not. Exactly. There's just a lot of missing information. So all of this started with a cemetery historian named Ray Reed. And he is actually kind of doing it as a hobby during his retirement. He started poring over genealogy websites, and he's been doing this since 2015. He's started locating and identifying death certificates, and like as he's doing this, he keeps coming across the name Zion Cemetery, and he's never heard of it before, right? So he reaches out to the Tampa Bay Times, and they're the ones, and the reporter Paul Guzzo is from Tampa Bay Times, and they're the ones that actually start looking into this.
I'm pretty sure Tampa Bay Times, like, a sneakily really good, like, newspaper.
Yeah, they have a lot of, there's a lot of things I found, yeah.
Yeah, I think it might be one of those
where old newspaper, too.
It's, like, tied to one of the universities as well, so they get, like, funding.
I'll get into that. Okay, yes, okay, yes. Cool. Okay. And so local historians, both local historians and, like, churches linked, that were supposedly linked to the Zion Cemetery, they had never heard of it. So some families who have also been in Tampa, you know, for generations, and when reporters talked to them, they were like, yeah, I like kind of recognize the name, but I don't know anything about it or what it is or where it is exactly. And that's really it. Hmm. So the Times started investigating, right? They looked into it. And what they did was they tried to locate the bodies to see if they had been moved, right? So there were 382 death certificates from 1913 to 1920 that were found with Zion Cemetery as the burial site. Hmm. And the original map was found with 800 plus burial sites. So they compared that with a list of those buried in other cemeteries, like maybe some were moved. And the other cemeteries that are over in Tampa is Memorial Park Cemetery, Jackson Heights Cemetery, Marty/Cullen Cemetery, Oaklawn Cemetery, and Woodlawn Cemetery. So they connected seven names that were at Memorial Park Cemetery and three that were at Woodlawn Cemetery. And so let's get into like the history a little bit. So Zion, like I said earlier, was founded in 1901 by Richard Doby, a wealthy black businessman, landowner, developer. He actually purchased the land in 1894 for $1 from Isaac W. Warner. And Richard Doby himself was a staple in the African American community, you know, and he helped establish that part of the community. And he looked at the land and he saw the need for a school, a church, and a cemetery. And at this time, Oaklawn Cemetery did allow both black and white burials, but it was getting full. So was Woodlawn Cemetery. They had a section for African Americans as well, but it was also getting full. And Tampa's population just grew and grew and grew during this time. So in 1901 was when the map of Zion was filed officially with the Hillsborough County Clerk's Office. And like I said, there are 2.5 acres, and it had 98 sections. And when the land was originally bought, Mount Carmel AME Church begins to hold services in the one-room Robles Pond Elementary School. So they had the school there, they had church services on Sunday, and then they had the cemetery. 4 years later, in 1905, in August, Zion was mentioned for the first time in a newspaper, but it wasn't described by name. It was just described as the African American cemetery, as quote, the African American cemetery north of the city limits. And this description is actually used a lot to describe Zion Cemetery as they poured through records and newspapers and such. So it was sold again in 1907 by Richard Doby, and he sold it for $300 to a Florida Industrial and Commercial Company. So the Florida Industrial and Commercial Company is a black-owned business that made caskets, they made furniture, and they made musical instruments. So they're the ones who, from that time, owned the land. And at this point, in 1907 as well, Mount Carmel AME Church moves a block away from Zion Cemetery. About 5 years later, in 1912, James J. Head, who is a former county treasurer, claims that he owns Zion Cemetery because he paid its back taxes. But Florida Industrial and Commercial Company, you know, they retained their ownership and they said, that's not true. This is our place. And it was after that time that the ownership was hard to track. Like, when I was reading through the AMA, they said the most difficult thing was tracking the ownership and the deals and who, when it was sold and what, who the land belonged to. And there's actually a pretty good stretch of time where they just don't know who owned the land or really what was done with it. And in 1914, Tampa grows to officially include Zion Cemetery as part of the town. A year later, in 1915, it was given a numerical address in the Polk City Directory. 3801 North Florida Avenue was officially Zion Cemetery. And in March of that year, it was auctioned off by the county sheriff's office to pay, like, a debt or something like that. Yeah, it was just...
Okay.
Yeah.
So it seems a bit crass, but okay.
Exactly. And it was not, at that point on is when it was really unclear as to who purchased the land when it was auctioned. So we really don't know. And in 1921, New Salem Christian Church appears in the city directory on Zion Cemetery property. So at this point, they're like looking through all the history records, and slowly Zion Cemetery starts to disappear, but it comes up in different places. And one of the places they found that this church was in the directory, and they said, oh, look, that's on the cemetery property, but there's no mention of the cemetery. A few years later, in December of 1923, the Tampa Times lists Zion Cemetery in a list of prominent cemeteries, but it doesn't appear in the annual Polk City Directory this year, and it never reappears. That was the last time that it was really mentioned. So by 1925, runs around, the mid-20s and 30s on, is really when Tampa as a city begins to change. It was, you know, originally, and this is like many, many, many cities in America, a majority black city. And it begins to be overrun with white suburban families who start to move in. So black communities.
This was before white flight. This was like where people went to and then they white flighted from.
Yes.
Yeah, that exactly. Happened in Chicago too, yeah.
For sure. So black communities are overrun by white developments. And so even those in the cemetery seem to be forgotten. And it's not, they aren't actively burying more people there.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what we think. We don't know.
Right, according to the records they could find.
Right.
Okay.
So in 1926, in August of 1926, Tampa Times reports that 50 bodies were removed, quote, from a black cemetery in St. Petersburg. But that's as close as they get to any really mention of bodies being moved from a black cemetery. That's it. January 28th of 1926, Alice W. Fuller of Los Angeles sells Zion to Tampa developer H.P. Kennedy for $1. So, and at this point, it's also unclear as to who sold it to Fuller and when. So how it got into her hands, we don't know. But all of a sudden, here it was being mentioned in the paper in 1926. And in 1929, in February of 1929, Tampa Times also reports that H.P. Kennedy obtained approval to build a 5-shop storefront on Florida Avenue. which is Zion Cemetery property. And in November 16th, 1951 is really the next time we hear anything about the cemetery, in that there were construction workers building a new apartment complex called Robles Park Village. And as they're digging, they found several unmarked graves, you know, during construction. Mm-hmm. And there were three caskets found and identified. And so city reporters said that the bodies from Zion Cemetery were relocated in 1925. So they were like, oh, just keep building. Like, it's fine. It should have been a red flag, but the reporter's right. Like, no, the bodies were moved. You're fine. You're good to go. And they got that information apparently by someone who had bought the property then. So, and like I said, there's really no records of that move. Mm-hmm. There were no records of the bodies that were located ever being moved. So, like I said before, there were seven found in, what did it say? There were seven found in at Memorial, and three at Woodlawn Cemetery, and then the three that were found during construction. So those 13 bodies, there was never any, they never really found any recollection of, or documentation of those bodies ever being moved anywhere. But they found them by basically comparing certificates.
Mm-hmm.
So genealogy sites also show that there are no death certificates after 1921 with Zion Cemetery labeled as the burial place. Also note that Memorial Cemetery opened in 1919, so maybe the thought there is that maybe Memorial took out all of the business, like people, they started burying people over there instead of in Zion. But again, we don't know. And you know, when human remains are moved, there should be a paper trail, okay? Yeah. And it's not surprising if there were, like, many people moved without documentation, again, because African Americans during this time and continue to be second-class citizens. But still, like,
especially then. I mean, there was a level of dehumanization that was acculturated that would have, you know, almost made it surprising if there were, you know, documentation.
Right.
You would almost assume there wouldn't be.
Yeah. And there's, you know, even if you know this is going on, there's only so much hell you can raise as an African American in, you know, the late 20s, you know? Like,
read a Richard Wright novel. I did that recently.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
You did.
If you want to get a bit of an idea of the scope of the tragedy of black life in
that's
the 20s and 30s
terrible.
In America.
And this is just
really
one of
good.
The many.
I would definitely tell people to read Richard Wright. I mean, it's a great, great writer, but yeah, it's crazy.
And this is just many, one of the many consequences.
Yeah.
So like I said, a large scale relocation, even of an African American cemetery would have at least been mentioned somewhere in the papers, but there was nothing. But there was one mention of relocating Zion remains found in a handwritten letter that was sent in 1989. So the mother of late civil rights activist Robert Saunders told Leland Hawes, who was the letter writer, that African-American bodies from, quote, a burial ground in an area north of downtown called Robles Pond, end quote, were moved to, quote, parts unknown. And, you know, as to where that is, who knows? You know, they've poured over tens of thousands of records and they never found the bodies.
Wow.
So let's talk about some of the people there. So those buried in Zion would have been laborers, and the women would have been stay-at-home mothers or domestic workers. And these are the people that basically built Tampa Bay themselves. And 20% of the death certificates found were born before the end of the Civil War in 1865. And it was the early to mid-20s as well were when the KKK were most active. Throughout the 20th century, it was the early to mid-20 decades, the 20s was when they were you know, open, had ads in newspapers, were openly recruiting people and shit like that.
There were millions of members, multiple members of Congress. It was reformulated in Indiana.
Oh, that's nice.
In the 20s, yeah, after it was stamped out by Grant.
Absolutely fucking terrible.
But it existed everywhere. It was, yeah, literally, like, tens of millions of members. Insane.
Yeah, so it's obvious to say that African Americans were pretty powerless. You know, it was difficult to fight for the land that they owned, right. Especially since they couldn't prove it, and even if they could prove it, nobody cared. So, what does this say? Lots most likely chose to... Oh, lots of people. I was like, lots? What? lots of people most likely chose to head north because of all this oppression, you know? And as a consequence, they cut off their connections from Tampa. And so not many people even there today would remember Zion anyway. Sure. Because a lot of those people whose ancestors and relatives from generations ago moved away.
It's interesting to consider these, like, different factors of creating mystery, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting to consider them in that context, like, sort of amorally or, like, divorced from their other effects. Like, what are things that create mystery? Yeah. Racism creates mystery.
Yeah, like, why is this even a mystery in the first place?
Right. You know, it's this...
Just repression, straight-up repression.
But and it's interesting that it's like a second kind of level connection, right? Because you're racist, you don't see these as people as people, right, in the way that you should. So you don't keep the records, so that creates the mystery. It's like finding these mysteries, I think, leads you to, it's a path to, like, a lot of truths about people.
It's like a puzzle.
And like anyway, I don't know where I was going with that.
No, you're right.
At all, but...
So, like I said, there was a series of articles, there were many, and one of them was some profiles of the people and of the obituaries they found, so I'm going to read some of them.
Great.
I have a man named L.G. Caro. He was born in 1839 and died in 1916. He was a minister who did weddings for local black couples. He was actually one of the oldest African-American residents living there at the time. And in June of 1913, he broke a record and he performed 22 weddings in 1 week.
That's a good record.
Oh, yeah. And he was also the founder of Greater Bethel Baptist Church, which he founded in the 1890s. And he also applied to run for Tampa City Council at the time in 1904, but he backed out and he endorsed white candidates, which was pretty surprising to a lot of the people because he had such a strong presence in the African-American community. Mm. Next, I have John Newton. He was born in 1858, died in 1915. He was a married deacon who also ran a small lunch counter next to a bakery on Tampa Street. In 1913, a customer refused to pay his bill in full, so John grabbed a kitchen axe and went after him. Customers broke up the altercation before anybody was hurt. Whoa. Oh, yeah. Perry Maxwell, born in 1878, died in 1913. He was only 35. December 13th, 1913, at 9 p.m., business owner William Archer accused Perry Maxwell of using profanity in front of his wife. A fight broke out, and Archer stabbed Maxwell to death during the altercation. And, like, he was only 35, so he was murdered.
My God.
Jesse Green, born in 1880, died in 1918. He was a native of South Carolina and described as a voodoo doctor. He was also murdered May 31st, 1918. He was, he died in the Clara Fry Hospital, and hospital attendants couldn't locate clothes for the burial, so police went out to his place, and they found his garments, over at his home, and police also found a man named E.J. Chatfield there at the house, who's also a voodoo practitioner, and he had Green's $500 life insurance policy. That's what he was rummaging around for, and he confessed and said that he had given Green a concoction, quote, containing iron nails, end quote. Yeah, it's fucked up. Jesse Green was 38. And I have, last but not least, I have Perry Johnson, 1896 to 1913. He was only 17 years old, a foster child, and he drowned in the estuary channel near the Seaboard Viaduct July 24th, 1913. He went swimming with two of his friends, and they coaxed him out into deeper water, and they didn't know that he couldn't swim well. So they panicked, swam back to shore, and they left him there, and he drowned. Oh, my God. Tragic.
Yeah.
So in a later article, our main man, Ray Reed, who kind of started this whole investigation, reported to have found names for 747 buried in Zion. So at this point, they're like, okay, we think that the population for Zion Cemetery was much bigger than originally thought.
Yeah.
Other death certificates found have Robles Pond Cemetery listed. So they're looking at these certificates and they're like, so maybe they were thinking of Zion Cemetery. There was no mention of a Robles Pond Cemetery in city directories or maps from the time. So they were like, and Robles Pond is also the property right. of Zion Cemetery.
Well, I remember you saying that people essentially use them interchangeably, right? There's like, oh, yeah, it's like the one in Robles Pond.
Yeah, or so, the one north of the city.
Right, yeah. North of downtown or whatever, right. yeah.
And the obituaries also say that Robles Pond was located on Florida Avenue.
Okay.
So as all this is being, you know, discovered and brought to light, the town of Tampa, they do want to continue investigating this. Tampa Bay Times reporter Paul Guzzo and his photographer James Burchuk, you know, they've poured over thousands of records and they've never found the bodies. And they did partner with University of South Florida. And the two current owners of what used to be Zion Land, Tampa Housing Authority, and owner of, I think he was the owner of one of the restaurants there, his name is Richard Gonsmart, and they're also partnered up in the investigation to see if there are more bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And there are plans in the future to use ground-penetrating radar to keep looking.
Yeah.
And two state senators also introduced legislation in late June, so like 3-4 weeks ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is like very current and it's still ongoing. They're still looking into it.
Yeah.
They introduced legislation to preserve and identify forgotten African American burial sites. One of them was Senator Janet Cruz of Tampa and Senator Audrey Gibson of Jacksonville. They announced that they'll be forming a task force to keep looking into to Zion Cemetery, and they have the same team looking for these graves have also looked for the graves of the students at Dozier School for Boys. So that is another mystery, which maybe I'll talk about, you know, within the next few weeks or so. But basically, the Dozier School of Boys is a reformed school from 1900 to 2011 that is notorious for its abuse, and it also has missing graves, and it's believed that over 100 boys died while attending the school there.
I seem to remember hearing about that.
Yeah. So the team that's looking for into that is also looking into this as well. So yeah, it's a tough search, and African Americans could not generally afford grave markers, you know, specifically ones that could stand the test of time. So that's also one of the reasons why.
Another source of the mystery.
Exactly, exactly. Just like you were saying, there's lots of layers to it.
Right. A lot of factors to consider.
Yes. Unfortunately, lost African American grave sites, I learned this today, are common. Like, It's a thing. Mm. 31 have been found throughout the country since 2010. Some examples of these are one that was found during construction of a General Services Administration office in Manhattan in 1991. African-American graves were found 24 feet below ground. Newburgh, New York, in 2017, workers that were converting a school to a courthouse found graves that had been severed by underground utility lines. Mm. And so to end, I have some quotes. And this is Byron Pressley, the preacher at First Mount Carmel AME Church, describing what it's like being on the property. He says, quote, "I don't know how to explain it to people, but there's a feeling you get as if there were people there. Their spirit was kind of still there because I could feel it. I stood there in awe. There used to be a cemetery there, and it just gave me chills," end quote. And I have a quote from Luis Vieira, who is the councilman representing the North Tampa area. He says that, and a lot of people say this, is not the only one saying that there should be a memorial honoring Zion Cemetery and its history that should be put up. Quote, "Tampa should honor the stories and names of those forgotten souls and work with proper local institutions like the University of South Florida to get all of the information necessary to respect and honor these names. These are the hands that built America, often against their will. Let's give them the respect that they are due," end quote.
Can't argue with that.
Can't argue with that. Agreed. So next we have Weird Shit in the News.
Oh, did you have sources?
Oh, my sources were the Tampa Bay Times articles. About it. Yeah. Paul Guzzo.
Right, you already talked about your thing. Sorry.
But before we get into Weird Shit in the News, sure. I want to talk about the recent death of Sadie Roberts Joseph.
Oh, I thought you were going to say John Paul Stevens.
Is he black?
No.
Then I don't.
He was
care.
A justice.
Should I care?
Sorry, go ahead.
Maybe I should care.
He
I don't
was
know.
99 years old.
I don't care. Let's talk about day. Do not ruin the memory of Sadie Roberts Joseph with a meager 99-year-old white man. All right.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's talk about Miss Roberts Joseph. She was a extremely well respected community leader in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. She was murdered, at the age of 75, and it's so fucked up. It's super, super fucked up. She was the founder of the city's African American History Museum. She was a huge activist.
Yeah.
She even, joined up with police to advocate against, drug use and violence in communities. She was a gem of a woman, and she was murdered, and her body was discovered in the trunk of her own car, and two anonymous phone calls is what led the police to find her body, and she died of asphyxiation. That's what they determined that was it most likely that she was suffocated. So on Tuesday they arrested this asshole named Ron Jermaine Bell, who was her tenant, and he owed her, I guess, like $1,200 or something really fucking stupid, so he killed her. And I just wanted to talk about this amazing woman, and I wanted to honor her as we were honoring, you know, lost graves of African Americans. I definitely wanted to talk about her. They called her a quote tireless advocate for peace, end quote.
Yeah.
Now let's lighten the mood. Okay. some weird shit in the news. Okay. What you got for me?
Hard left turn. Okay. Okay. So, mine comes from the AP oddities page. Like, I like to go there and find my weird shit.
A classic.
Right. And the headline is Rattlesnake Uranium Whiskey Found During Traffic Stop.
I heard about this!
In Guthrie, Oklahoma.
Oklahoma!
You know Oklahoma sucks. I'm from Texas. Sorry if you're from Oklahoma. I don't mean anything against you. I'm from Texas. It's a rivalry, okay? So police in Oklahoma say they found a rattlesnake, a canister of radioactive powdered uranium, and an open bottle of Kentucky Deluxe whiskey during a traffic stop of a vehicle that had been reported stolen. So,
wow.
Not a good thing. So yeah, Stephen Jennings was the name of the guy. He was charged with possession of a stolen vehicle, transporting an open container of liquor. They don't know how he got the uranium. Apparently, you can buy uranium ore on Amazon. That's what it says in this article. Don't do that. I wouldn't do that if I were me or you or anyone else.
If you were you.
Am I me? What is reality?
What is reality?
So, yeah, it's, I don't know. There wasn't only those things, okay? There were a few other things in the car as well. So there was a gun. Oh, it's always good to have around, I guess.
Yep.
Or not. A terrarium. Containing a pet timber rattlesnake.
Oh, my God.
Yep. That car had everything. Poor snake. That car had everything you would need for your whole life. We don't know that he necessarily abused the snake.
What the fuck was with the uranium?
Who knows?
Is it a mystery, perhaps?
It's a mystery. Jesus Christ. Okay, go.
I have weird shit in the news.
Do you?
And my weird shit in the news is actually... It's weird.
In the news.
It's pretty trendy. Y'all probably heard about it.
Oh, yes. Right.
But I definitely wanted to talk about it because it's...
It's weird.
It's weird. It's in our
realm.
Although
it's also kind of predictable.
Well, I didn't think it was predictable. Okay, so let's talk about it. Okay. There are 400,000 plus people...
who are going to storm Area 51. Or not.
I joined the event.
Good for you.
I think 75% and more it's a joke, it's a meme, it became popular, randomly popular Facebook event. And
the real mystery is how many people are really going to do it. Sorry, go.
I mean, you're right. All right. And the authorities have already said, hey guys, we're armed and ready for y'all. It's not happening till September 20th. And the event is titled Storm Area 51. They can't stop all of us. God damn it.
That sounds like...
Memes everywhere.
That just sounds like famous last words, you know? It's like, no, I'm pretty sure they could stop everyone if they wanted to.
Oh,
and as
God.
We talked about in our episode about Area 51,
there's
the
really
fences
not...
and barriers are miles away from anything interesting. And then what? You're going to find, the new spy plane? Okay, great. Cool. Now you know what it looks like. I don't get it.
Holy
I don't
shit.
Get people sometimes.
No, I don't. I think it's...
It's zeitgeist,
a lot of UFO enthusiasts who...
Sure.
I don't think they're serious. I'm excited for September now. I'm genuinely excited to who's going
to
actually...
this day.
Get out and go... do it and they'll get there. There's 11 people.
Right. And it's this happens. People go to Area 51, they try to get in. It's not this hasn't happened several times.
I know, this one just got really popular really fast.
But that's what the internet's good for, right? Whether you're trying to foment protest in Hong Kong or fucking storm Area 51, internet's
Those
good
are
for
two
you
very
know, disparate.
Yeah.
I was trying to make a artful juxtaposition. Thanks for listening, guys.
Yeah, guys, thanks so much.
80 episodes in. So, yeah, we're going to keep pumping them out and try to keep getting better.
Yeah, we'll try to get our shit together. Let's get together. Why don't you? That's our new segment.
So hit us up on Instagram,
Facebook
and
Twitter,
Mario Text 30. Have a good Wednesday or Thursday, I guess. This is coming out pretty late, but anyway.
Thanks for your patience.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.